Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, sanitation and antibiotics have saved the lives of many, but are they also culprits behind some of our modern diseases? Then, how the meaning of the Second Amendment has changed since its introduction, and what it might mean for today's debate about gun laws. Our next guest argues that we may have gone overboard in killing our microbes, and that may be causing some of today's epidemics. Martin Blaser is a professor of translational medicine and director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. His new book is called Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Welcome, Martin Blaser. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
I'm really happy to be here.
Your primary argument in Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues is really that a lot of our illnesses today are really resulting from killing off a lot of these microbes that help our health in many ways. I thought where we should start is what these microorganisms are themselves. You describe them almost like ecosystems.
Most of the cells in the human body are, in fact, microbial cells. That is bacteria and, to a lesser extent, fungi and protozoa. Where the bacterial cells outnumber our human cells at least 3-1 and maybe 10-1. So we're mostly bacteria. If you took all the bacteria together and put them on a scale, they'd weigh about 3 or 4 pounds, about the same weight as our brain. And what we know is that these bacteria essentially are ancient, that we got them from our mom, and she got them from her mom, and so on and so forth, all the way back in time. Not only from our mom, but that's a very important source. These bacteria do many good things for us. They help train our immune system. They help us digest food. They make vitamins for us. They help keep out invaders. So these are very useful. We could call them the good guys.
You've said in the book that really this ecology of microbes, you call it the microbiome, are really key to our immune system. What examples can you give us?
We've been doing a lot of studies in mice, and others have done studies in mice, and it's clear that the distribution of these microbes, let's say we and others in the field are doing a lot of work, we're taking a census. We're saying, okay, which microbes are present in my body and in your body, and what about my intestine versus my skin? How are they similar? How are they different? And I can tell you that if we compared my skin and your skin, our skin is closer to each other than my skin is to my mouth, for example, because each niche has its own population, as you said, its own ecosystem.
Is there some comparison we can make to the non-microbe world that can help us to understand these unique ecosystems that each of us has?
Maybe we should start by saying, what is an ecosystem? And that's a collection of species, more or less all living together. We see that in ponds and lakes, in forests, on prairies. We see all different kinds of species. On the prairies, we see different kinds of grasses and different animals and worms and fungi. They're all living together. They've been living together in general for stable ecosystems for a very long period of time. And they really pretty much define the life that is present. And they're kind of hard to budge, so that when an invader comes in, they have a hard time getting a foothold because the local species keep them out. And of course, we think that's true within the human body as well, that the populations of different kinds of species in our skin, on our gut, in our mouth, very complex groups of organisms, they're functioning to do their work. They're all trying to eat and have babies and baby microbes. In doing this, they have functions that are beneficial to us, and that's why we're so interested in them.
Let's talk about what is happening, the antibiotic use, because this is really the thrust of your book. You're essentially saying that most of these modern plagues, especially things like obesity, are connected directly to the abundance of antibiotics and also when they're introduced to people.
First, let's start with some facts, and that is that since World War II, a number of diseases have become much more common than they were before. And that's what we could call our modern epidemics or our modern plagues. And these include such things as asthma and skin allergies, eczema, food allergies, wheat allergy, includes obesity and diabetes, even autism, inflammatory bowel disease. So imagine that you had 10 diseases that are all arising more or less in parallel. either they have 10 different causes that all happened at the same time, or there's one thing that is underlying everything. And that's my theory, which I discuss in Missing Microbes, is that there is one thing underlying it, and that is a change in our ancient microbiome, our ancient ecosystem that we've had since time immemorial, as an unintended consequence of all the medical advances that we have, including especially antibiotics.
And let's break down some of the numbers. You talked about how much more obesity there is just in the past decade, not only in the U.S., but you noticed it in places like Chichen Itza.
Obesity is rising all over the world, especially in developed countries like the United States and Europe, but it's beginning to be present in China. It's beginning to be present in India. Even in Africa, obesity may be a bigger problem than malnutrition is. In the last decades, this has just come up worldwide. So something very important must be going on that is shared. Now, there's a lot of interest, of course, in food and calories and taking in too many calories. But diet alone hasn't been sufficient for us to understand what's going on in obesity. Diet is important, but it's not enough. And again, my hypothesis is that changes in our microbiome, these cells that are doing work for us, are important. And I want to introduce another concept, and that is we can think about the organisms in us at different stages of life. And to me, the most important organisms are the ones that are present early in life when we're really young kids, or our kids are really young, or our grandkids. We know now that these organisms are part of the development of our systems, of our processes in the body, metabolism, immunity, maybe even cognition. So if you perturb them early in life, you may change the course of development toward an individual who is pretty much destined to gain a lot of weight, for example.
How is this happening? One, you mentioned, is the antibiotics introduced at a very young age because it kills a lot of these microbes or it disturbs the balance. But the other you talk about is this increasing use of cesareans. How can that be related?
So we humans are mammals, and one of the characteristics of mammals is that they produce live birth, and the baby goes through a birth canal. So we don't lay eggs like birds do. And in the course of passing from the womb through the birth canal, a baby is picking up all these microbes from their mom. Part of the heredity of being a mammal is that you pick up your mom's microbes on your way out, and then you continue to pick up mom's microbes through contact with skin and mouth. But when a baby is born by cesarean section, they're missing this early contact. They're missing their introduction with the organisms that in other kids become the foundation for all the microbes in their body.
The connection with things like diabetes, celiac disease, how are these all related?
Well, there have been epidemiologic studies in which groups of moms and babies have been studied, large groups of hundreds or thousands of people, showing that babies born by C-section were more likely to have some of the markers of obesity or celiac disease or juvenile diabetes. So it's not that this is a theoretical risk. There's already evidence suggesting that there may be a cost to C-section that nobody was appreciating. Not a cost a day after birth or a week after birth, but a cost that's manifesting 10 years after birth, 20 years after birth. And there are precedents for this. And I want to come back to one of the earlier points, because for me, one day a light bulb went off, and that was, I knew for a long time that farmers feed antibiotics to their farm animals so that they'll gain weight. This is very widely done. It's where most of the antibiotics in the United States are going, on the farm, not to people. They're going to farm animals for the express purpose of promoting growth. And the reason they do this and they use so much antibiotics is because it works. They found that if they give antibiotics to young animals, they'll gain weight faster. Their feed efficiency improves. That's the ability to change food calories into body mass. And one day for me, about 10 years ago, a light bulb went off, and I thought, well, farmers are doing that, feeding antibiotics to increase the growth of their livestock. What are we doing to our children? is it possible that the antibiotics we're giving our young kids for their throat infections, their ear infections, is having an unintended consequence, and that is that it's fattening them up. And that's what we've been working on for the last 10 years, and I talk about some of this work in Missing Microbes.
In terms of the unintended consequences, there are also others. We've got antibiotics in our water, in our soil, in our food. We're also seeing resistant bacteria.
Anytime antibiotics are used, it selects for resistance. Antibiotics will kill the susceptible bacteria, and the ones that are resistant will remain, and they'll take over the spot where the susceptible ones were. This is what Charles Darwin called natural selection. He didn't even recognize this with microbes, but ultimately, Darwin was right. If you don't believe in Darwin's concepts of evolution, all you have to do is study bacteria and the development of antibiotic resistance, and you see it very clearly.
What's the consequence of some of these resistant bacteria?
Consequences, unfortunately, are very serious. Before we had antibiotics, people would die from pneumonia. They would die from meningitis. They might die of blood poisoning from a splinter or something like that. There were many fatal infections. Now, with antibiotics, most of those infections are treatable. Most of them are curable. Also, in order to do cancer chemotherapy, to do transplantation, to do major surgery, we needed an umbrella of antibiotics around so that if somebody gets sick, we can treat them. I'm a doctor. If we have somebody who's getting chemotherapy, infection is a very major problem. So we can treat them with antibiotics. It would be a shame to suppress somebody's tumor, but then they die of an infection. So we, in order to have modern medicine, we need antibiotics. And if the antibiotics stop working because our bacteria have become resistant to them, then we could move back to an era when we can't do these surgeries. It's not just the cases of pneumonia, but it's the very ability to do things that we now take for granted, surgery, hip replacements. You know, if you didn't have antibiotics, you couldn't really do hip replacements because infections occur and they could be lethal.
And given that the antibiotics are so prevalent now in food and water, in the soil, and is there any avoiding it?
Well, that's a very good question. There have been surveys that showed that because of the tremendous use of antibiotics on the farm, when you go to the supermarket, your meat may be contaminated by antibiotics. According to the regulations, it's not supposed to happen. But surveys have shown that it does happen. Not in every case, but in some cases. And we haven't surveyed this enough, but we know it can be present in meat. We know it can be present in milk. And some cities, their drinking water intake is just downstream of the effluent from one of these large industrial farms. So they're getting antibiotics in their water. What we can say is that there are probably millions of exposures every day in the United States of people to low levels of antibiotics, trace levels of antibiotics. What's the consequence? We don't know. Maybe there is no consequence. Maybe it's completely safe. Or maybe when you talk about it millions of times, that's what's contributing to so many of these rising diseases.
I think I saw in your book, Missing Microbes, that they had found resistant bacteria in about half the samples of meat that they tested.
I mean, it depends on the survey, but whether it's 20% or 80%, when you eat meat that you get at the supermarket, there's a reasonable chance that there is some trace level of antibiotic. And also the milk that our children drink. Kids who are drinking milk every day, there's a risk that they're getting antibiotics. Some parents say, my child has never had an antibiotic, but probably that's not true.
I noticed you were writing about neurons in our guts, and you said there's something like 100 million neurons. And these neurons signal to the brain all kinds of things related to hunger, mood, cognitive development. But they're signaling based on interaction with microbes. How is this affected by the antibiotic use?
I'll give you the bottom line first. We don't know. It's a wide open question. But as you say, there's an increasing body of evidence that the nature of the microbes in our gut, the composition of them, the genes that they carry, affect the signals, the neural signals going from our gut via a number of nerves right up to the brain. I mean, sometimes people say, I feel hungry in my gut. Somehow your brain has learned that. That's a very simple example. But there are increasing connections between the gut and the development of the brain in terms of thinking, of cognition. There's some work suggesting there's a relationship with mood. You know, the nervous system is a big chemical factory, and some of the chemicals that are coming in from below could definitely influence what's going on.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Martin Blaser, and he is the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Now, let's go back to the plagues. We've talked a lot about obesity. We talked a little bit about diabetes. We mentioned celiac disease. But there were several others that you had talked about in the book. One is the esophageal reflux, which causes heartburn. One is asthma. One is eczema. How many of these so-called modern plagues do you think are related to the overuse of antibiotics?
You mentioned esophageal reflux, asthma, and eczema. And these have been related to an organism that lives in the stomach called Helicobacter pylori. It's an organism I've been studying for about 30 years. And Helicobacter was discovered in the 1980s to be a major cause of stomach ulcers. In fact, the people who discovered it won the Nobel Prize. And later, we and others discovered that this bacteria had a major role in stomach cancer. So everything was indicating that this was a very bad organism. But the more we studied it, the more we realized that this organism is quite ancient, that people have had it in their stomach since time immemorial. But as a result of modern life, this bacterium is disappearing. And this is one of the places that I got the idea about four missing microbes, that some of our ancient organisms that are longtime residents, our friends, are disappearing. Well, Helicobacter is not just a friend because it can cause ulcers and it can cause cancer, but there now is a wide body of research suggesting that Helicobacter also protects the esophagus, protecting against high acid and reflux, and that people who don't have Helicobacter are at much higher risk for getting reflux esophagitis, and occasionally they can get a condition called Barrett's esophagus, and occasionally they can get esophageal cancer as well. So as Helicobacter is disappearing, gastric cancer is disappearing, but esophageal cancer is rising, and asthma is rising, and eczema is rising. And we have found evidence linking the lack of Helicobacter to these diseases, as if Helicobacter pylori was protective against getting these diseases, and now we've lost it.
In essence, if we were going to then turn to solutions, would you say that besides the reduction in use of the antibiotics, do you think that the germophobia is a little bit too extreme? We thought that we had to be more sanitary in order to protect life. Now, are we too sanitary?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the term you use, germophobia. Because there are some very bad germs, like the germ that causes tuberculosis or the virus that causes HIV, etc., because there are very bad germs, we have focused on those, forgetting for the moment that the world is full of germs. We live in a world of bacteria. Most of them are neutral to us, and many of them are good for us. They're beneficial to us, like many of the organisms in our own body. And so, to me, the fear is that by using these antibacterial substances, we use these soaps, they're in certain foods, etc., that we're causing collateral damage to our good guys, the good bacteria. And ultimately, when we have people washing their hands tens of millions of times a day across the United States with these antibacterial soaps, I don't know whether we're doing more good or more harm. It just hasn't been determined. But on a positive note, I think positive, the state of Minnesota just a few days ago banned the use of antibacterial soaps. They said there's no reason to use it. It's no better than soap and water. And I applaud that because I'm concerned that those antibiotic soaps are wounding our microbiome, our ancient composition. It's not like it's wounding us, but we're getting a lot of benefit from it. It's not clear that we're getting any benefit from it. And so there's only a biological cost.
In terms of other potential policies, solutions, it sounds like you also think this overuse of antibiotic on the farms is a big problem.
Yes, it is a big problem because it's spilling over into humans, the antibiotic residues in food. And also it's a problem because of resistant organisms. When antibiotics are used on the farm, It selects for bacteria that are resistant to their action, and sometimes these bacteria come over to humans. There have been many examples with Salmonella and Campylobacter, two important disease-causing organisms. The use on the farm has made some of these strains antibiotic resistant, and now when people are getting the infections from eating the foods of animal origin, they're getting infected with antibiotic resistant organisms. So this actually has been well known for a number of years, and the Food and Drug Administration is taking some early steps to ban the use of antibiotics on the farm. I would call it baby steps, and our free and aroused citizenry has to push the policymakers to actually do the right thing, to get these antibiotics out of the farm. In Europe, they banned it about 10 years ago.
The other issue that you talked about in your book that you said you were still uncertain about is when you were asked about probiotics and whether or not they are good for us. How would you respond now?
About the same. You know, I can make a couple statements about probiotics. One is that there are a lot of them. If you go to the grocery store or the health food store or the drug store, there are shelves and shelves of probiotics. They represent many different microbes, different formulations, different labels. Some of them it appears to be the same microbe but with a completely different label or mixtures of these. So there are a lot of them. The record suggests that they're generally safe, but they're almost completely untested. I have no idea what they do because they really haven't been subject to rigorous clinical testing. And if you're going to claim that something is good for you for some particular reason, then there should be a test behind that. In the whole probiotic field, there's very little testing. So I don't know. It's a crapshoot.
Martin Blaser, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's really my pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
The book, again, is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, how the meaning of the Second Amendment has changed over time and what it means for today's gun debates. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The recent shootings in Santa Barbara, California, again raised questions about how to address gun violence, particularly in light of gun advocates' arguments about the meaning of the Second Amendment. Our next guests have traced the historical meaning of the Second Amendment from the very first days that it was drafted and proposed. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law and author of The Second Amendment, a biography, and Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, the Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thank you so much for being with us. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Both of you have fascinating books about the Second Amendment and how it's evolved and been constructed over American history. Perhaps we should start with the drafting of the Second Amendment itself. Michael Waldman, let's start with you. You wrote that the drafting of the Constitution occurred in secret by revolutionaries who wanted a strong central government. These were the Federalists. But the anti-Federalists who opposed the Constitution were worried about losing their state militias. Start us here and tell us how the Second Amendment came about.
Thank you. Yes, the drafting of the Second Amendment, as with so much of the debate over it over many years, really had to do so much about people's fears and feelings about government. So the revolutionaries who had helped to fight the American Revolution, who helped fight the War of Independence, they saw that these state militias were cherished, were revered by the public, had done such a great job at, say, Lexington and Concord, but weren't up to the task of actually pulling together a modern, or for its time, a modern nation. They moved the country in their draft constitution toward a more consolidated government. At the time, people believed that a great threat to liberty here in the colonies or in the United States and in England too was something called a standing army, the idea that there'd be a professional army at the whim of the king that could oppress people and could oppress their rights. The alternative to that were these militias. We know it now as the well-regulated militia, but it was something very different from anything we really have right now. It was the militias were made up of all adult men, really eventually all adult white men, from the age of 16 to 60. They were required to be part of the militia, and they were required to own a gun, and they actually had their guns at home. And so that was the norm. That was the central military force of the new nation, were these 13 state militias. When the Constitution was released, it was a great moment, a great debate. We all know that the huge tumult and controversy that resulted, one of the fears that anti-federalists had was that the new national government would crush these state militias. As you know, and as your listeners probably know, the fight for the Constitution went state by state, and eventually to get it enacted, to get it ratified, there was the idea that there would be some amendments later on, maybe a Bill of Rights added. And that was what led to the inclusion eventually of the Second Amendment.
You found that there wasn't much of a discussion around owning a gun for self-defense so much as it was around the civic duty of serving in a militia.
As best we know, and there's always the fog of history, people had guns. They were expected to be able to have guns. There was a tradition of being able to defend yourself and your home. But if you look at the notes from James Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention, or the debate on the floor of the House of Representatives when they marked up the Second Amendment, or with scattered exceptions, when you look at the official records of the ratifying conventions, what they were really talking about was the right to bear arms against tyranny through these militias. And, you know, people ask me, was it an individual right or was it the militia that was protected? And it was really both. It was the individual right to bear arms to fulfill the duty to serve in a militia. And, of course, that's such a different worldview than we have in so many ways. It's very hard to take that and translate it into something current and relevant now.
Adam Winkler, you also explored the various iterations of the Second Amendment before it became what it is now, and the language that you found from people introducing from various states seemed like it was that the state could not disarm people unless the person was creating a public threat. What can you tell us about some of that language?
Thanks for having me on, first and foremost, and always a pleasure to be here with Michael Waldman. And I should say that Michael's right. You know, when you look at the history of the drafting of the Second Amendment, you don't see a lot of discussions of personal use of firearms to defend your home against criminals and whatnot. Now, in part, that's due to the technology at the time. Firearms weren't particularly good for defending your home against criminals or someone who might try to invade your home. You could really only get one shot off if it was already loaded, the firearm, and then it would take you about a minute or 2 minutes to reload the firearm and to be able to shoot it again. And the firearms weren't terribly accurate, even at somewhat close range. So not surprised that people didn't think of firearms primarily as a way of defending themselves against criminals. But I think Michael also hits upon an important theme of self-defense writ more broadly. That is, the idea that we would have an armed citizenry to protect us against tyranny was part of a broader conception of self-defense. The idea that we, the people, could defend ourselves if we were faced with criminality of the most tyrannical sort. But I think it's also important when we think about the drafting of the Second Amendment to think about that amendment in the same terms we think about all the other constitutional amendments. My own view is that we shouldn't be bound by the original intent or original understanding of constitutional provisions so strictly that we must understand that the Constitution embodies a set of principles and that those principles evolve and morph to meet the demands of the day. It doesn't matter exactly how the framers thought the Second Amendment would apply to particular laws. It matters how we, the people, over the course of American history, have interpreted that provision. And I think one of the things that Michael's book and my book definitely agree on is that over the course of American history, increasingly, the Second Amendment gets interpreted by we the people to mean more than just protection for state militias, that it becomes probably by the 1820s and 1830s pretty clearly interpreted by many people to be an individual right. It's never a uniform interpretation. The militia theory continues on for a long time and still is with us today. But nonetheless, when we think about the Second Amendment, we should think about it in the same terms we think of other constitutional amendments and not be too bound to what the framers of the Constitution intended to do by that amendment.
Michael Waldman?
I think Adam is right, and I certainly learned a great deal from his scholarship on this, that over time, you really had an evolution where the country grew more individualistic. As soon as the Second Amendment was enacted, the militia system began to crumble. People just stopped showing up. If you look at the drawings of the militias from an earlier period, they all look very heroic, and by the 1820s, they all are sort of lampooned as drunkards and lounging around having a party instead of actually doing military service. The country grew more individualistic. It moved west. People began to think of things in a much more, in a sense, modern, personal, ambition-focused way. So there were plenty of guns, and alongside them, there were plenty of gun laws. And the courts and the Constitution was simply not that much of a factor. It was not very common during the 1800s that the courts would apply any constitutional rights to stop legislatures from acting on almost anything. It happened, but pretty rarely, and almost always applied just to Congress. And so over time, the country evolved, it changed. The original meaning proved not to be a particularly useful guide, and we wound up having gun rights and gun laws going hand in hand without the courts stepping in to articulate a very precise theory of it.
Both of you in your books wrote about some of these laws that were passed at the time. Some towns actually banned guns altogether when you went into them. Others were really just regulating them or asking for registration of them. Adam Winkler, what did you find?
We find really, in some ways, the first modern versions of gun control laws being adopted in the 1820s and over the next 30 years or so, when states start adopting laws to ban the concealed carry of firearms. The framers had gun control laws, too. There were laws that barred, for instance, racial minorities from having guns. There were militia laws, and there were some equivalent to what we might think of as safe storage laws in the founding era, laws that barred people in certain cities from having a loaded firearm in their home. That was largely about protection against fires that could occur because of explosive powder. But nonetheless, we had some gun control laws even in the founding era. But sort of in some ways, you might think that the modern, quote-unquote, regime of gun control begins with concealed carry legislation. One of the surprising things I found in doing the research for my book was that those laws first arose in the South, and they weren't designed particular to ban African Americans from carrying guns in public. African Americans in the South, slaves were not allowed to own firearms at all, so they couldn't carry them for sure. This was about restricting otherwise law-abiding white people from carrying their guns around because they might actually use those firearms in a duel or an honor killing, which were those kinds of things that were common in that era. And we saw the spread of these concealed carry laws in the early 1800s. And this really forces the courts for the first time to deal with the constitutionality of gun control. They don't address it primarily under the Second Amendment, but there are cases that go up to the state Supreme Courts challenging these gun control laws as a violation of state right to bear arms provisions. That's also another thing that's worth remembering when we think about the right to bear arms. We really focus on the Second Amendment most of the time. And in truth, the right to bear arms has been embodied in American law in a variety of other ways, including state constitutional provisions. Today, 43 of 50 states have provisions protecting individuals' right to have guns for personal protection. Those laws became pretty commonplace as states joined the Union in the 1800s. Those provided the first opportunity for courts to address the constitutionality of gun control.
Let's also look at the 14th Amendment, because Michael Waldman's book saw the 14th Amendment authors as incorporating the Second Amendment as an effort for former slaves to protect themselves against organized violence. Michael Waldman, what can you tell us about this?
Of course, the 14th Amendment followed the Civil War and followed the period when hundreds of thousands of African Americans, freedmen, bore arms in the United States Army. And when the war was over, a lot of them returned home. And it became, we tend to think of Grant and Lee at Appomattox, and that was the end of that, but it in fact was a low-grade guerrilla war between the races. Basically, the white Southerners terrorized the African Americans through institutions such as the Ku Klux Klan and other vigilantes. And so the radical Republicans, as they were known, the supporters of civil rights in the United States Congress, they were trying all different kinds of ways to protect the Southern blacks. And one of the key ways was to make sure they could be armed. And that state laws that were passed by the white Southerners right after the Civil War, taking away guns just from African Americans, would be overruled. So one of the purposes for some of the drafters of the 14th Amendment was to make sure that Southern African Americans could get guns. Now, that in some respect begs some of the tough questions that we face today, because first of all, that's not really how they sold it to the American public when they were running for office in 1866, supporting the 14th Amendment, saying the goal of this is to get guns into the hands of the African Americans. It's also not really clear if they meant that everyone had the right to a gun or that you couldn't discriminate between whites and blacks. And it was also the case that the military governments that ran the South in the later part of Reconstruction had plenty of these kinds of laws that Adam Winkler was talking about, dealing with concealed carrying of weapons and other kinds of things like that. So again, even there, there seemed to be a strong feeling that the ability to protect yourself was a basic right, but that somehow that did not run afoul against the idea that you could have strong laws, strong criminal laws, strong public protections. And in any case, when the courts, when Reconstruction ended and the Supreme Court got involved and stripped away so many of the protections that African Americans had, one of the things they stripped away was they ruled that the Bill of Rights just did not apply to the states. And so, and it was states not only that had these Second Amendment type of provisions in their Constitution, but that made criminal laws and gun laws. So the relevance of the Second Amendment got yanked away, and the federal courts were pretty consistent on that for a long time.
And meanwhile, Adam Winkler, you noted in your book that the militias in the South essentially became slave patrols.
That's right. When we think about the well-regulated militia referenced in the Second Amendment, we think of, you know, people getting out their guns ready to fight in an instant, the so-called Minutemen of the Revolutionary period. But as Michael points out, soon after the Revolution, people quickly lost faith in the militias as a way of defending the nation. In part, that was the result of the War of 1812, when states like Massachusetts refused to send their militiamen to defend the nation. And as a result, England came in and burned Washington to the ground and probably would have taken over our country again and reversed the revolution had it not been for England having to deal with a little problem in Europe by the name of Napoleon. And had England not been distracted, we probably would have returned to English citizenry. And so the militias in the South were repurposed and became slave patrols. First, before the Civil War, efforts to capture escaped slaves would be undertaken by these state militias so that the slaves would not run away and they would be returned to their owners. Even after the Civil War, where we didn't have the militias having that same use, the militias still survived in some form, at least really up until the 20th century. But as Michael says, it's really nothing like what we know today. Sometimes people say, well, the militia, that's like the National Guard. But that's not the case. The National Guard is a trained group of citizens who fight for the nation, but are heavily trained and are not just sort of the general mass of people. They are a select group of people. Whereas the citizens' militia that the framers envisioned, as Michael says, are virtually the entire male citizenry that were of age and capable of bearing arms. Interestingly enough, there is a country, a nation that still has these state militias. Switzerland still defends itself without a standing army and has citizen militias. And in Switzerland, they provide their young men with so-called military assault rifles at the age of 18 and a box of ammunition. So there are some of these militias still out there, just not in the United States.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. And we're talking about the construction of the Second Amendment over the history of the U.S. into what it is today. We're speaking with Michael Waldman, whose book is called The Second Amendment, A Biography, and Adam Winkler, whose book is called A Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thematically, if we were to continue down this path, we then find that the Black Panthers continued this idea of being able to have guns to protect oneself. Adam Winkler, this is something you elaborated on quite a bit in your book.
It's interesting in doing my research for Gunfight how many ties between the NRA and the modern gun rights movement and the Black Panthers there were. In many ways, the Black Panthers sort of gave rise to the modern gun rights movement, at least provided various models and themes that the NRA and the modern gun rights movement would pick up upon. And part of that was that the Black Panthers were formed in the 1960s by some African-American activists in Oakland who were disappointed with the progress of the civil rights movement. They thought that peaceful, nonviolent protest of the sort that Martin Luther King engaged in wasn't getting us very far, had not brought the promised rewards, and that instead the African Americans still confronted a hostile police force in cities like Oakland, and people needed the right to bear arms to protect themselves. We remember Malcolm X's famous photograph of him peering out the window with an M1 carbine in his hand, and that kind of embodied the philosophy of the Black Panthers too. And the Black Panthers very explicitly said, we have a Second Amendment right to have our guns. And they said, we have a Second Amendment right not only to have guns in our home to protect ourselves against criminals, we have a right to have those guns in public where we face great threats. And not only that, we have a right to have those guns to use them against the tyranny of a government that's hostile to our rights. An idea that, of course, became very popular among the gun rights activists in the 80s and 90s. And it's one of the ironies that gun control laws that were adopted to try to disarm the Black Panthers, like California's law that was passed in 1968 to disarm them, that those laws helped spark a backlash that led to gun rights support among rural white conservatives, even though those laws were originally designed to outlaw guns or to eliminate gun ownership or reduce it by urban Black left-leaning radicals.
Let's look specifically at the NRA. Michael Waldman, you opened Chapter 5 with the NRA billing itself as the, quote, nation's longest standing civil rights organization. And you say that's not how it started.
Well, it started after the Civil War, where the Union officers had grown perturbed by the poor marksmanship of their troops. And just as Adam Winkler said, before that, the guns were not very accurate. It sort of didn't matter if you were a good shot or not, because it wouldn't necessarily work anyway. But by the end of the war, it was a much more mechanized military. And these former officers felt that they needed to keep training people and preserve the marksmanship. They recruited General Ambrose Burnside, who we know for his famous whiskers, sideburns come from his name, and as the honorary chair. And they were not a lobbying organization. They gave guns. They trained people. Over time, they were especially identified with preparedness, but especially eventually with the interests of sportsmen, of hunters, and people who were concerned about that. And while it's true that the NRA lobbied occasionally, it was not deeply involved in politics. And, for example, when the cities began passing gun laws, when people crowded into the cities in the beginning of the 20th century, and states and cities began passing laws dealing with carrying guns in that context, the NRA didn't get involved. And then when the federal government first passed a federal gun law in the 1930s, actually to deal with bank robbers, Bonnie and Clyde, and people like that, who were now crossing state lines with their newfangled technology of the getaway car, they passed, under Franklin Roosevelt, the first federal gun law, and the NRA not only didn't oppose it, it was asked in testimony before Congress, are you worried that this affects the Constitution? And they said, we haven't given it any thought from that perspective. Well, along comes the 1960s, along comes the turmoil of the 60s and the perceived liberalism of the courts and the social unrest. And in the 1970s, you saw a really sharp change in the NRA. Not only in the NRA, but the NRA, it was very visible. In 1977, the NRA indicated that it was going to move its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado as a symbol of its retreat from politics. And at the annual convention in 77 in Cincinnati, it was called the Revolt at Cincinnati, 1,000 activists came and essentially deposed the leadership of the NRA, and a far more radical, really, group of leaders came in and really changed the focus both to strong opposition to gun control, but also a constitutional crusade, really elevating the Second Amendment and its language about the right to keep and bear arms to the heart of the NRA's mission. And to this day, when you go to the NRA headquarters in Virginia and you go into the lobby, there on the wall in big letters is the Second Amendment, except it's the part about the well-regulated militia is simply edited out. They have two dots. They don't even get three dots. And that really began, that shift came in that revolt in Cincinnati, and it was interestingly at a moment when we saw a lot of traditional American institutions move very far to the right in response to the 60s. You had the churches, the evangelical churches and the Baptists, same thing. A lot of the farm organizations, you had the tax revolt in California in 1979. You had the Sagebrush Rebellion against Interior Department environmental policies. It all became very insurrectionist in tone, and that wound up fusing with the Republican Party in many ways as a kind of a very potent political coalition, and that helped create the environment we're in now on this issue.
Adam Winkler, you also detailed quite a bit about the NRA in your book. You noted that they were at the forefront of gun control laws in the 20s and 30s.
Well, that's right. In the 1920s and 30s, the president of the NRA was instrumental in drafting laws that restricted people's ability to carry guns in public. These laws required you to have a permit before you could carry a gun in public, and only awarded permits to people who had good moral character or a good reason to carry a gun in public. The idea was to limit people's ability to have guns in public. It's interesting that today the NRA is filing lawsuits all over the country challenging those very same laws that they helped pass. And indeed, there's not many of them left. Over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a big push among gun rights advocates to loosen the concealed carry rules. And about 40 states have loosened their rules and changed those laws so that it is a lot easier today to carry guns in public than it was under the NRA's version, preferred legislation of the 1920s. And indeed, one of the interesting things is if you look at the American Rifleman, which is the NRA signature publication that it sends out to all members, you can go through back issues in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, and it's amazing. You can just sit there and look in the library, as I've done, and you just go page after page after page looking for some mention of the Second Amendment, and you just don't find it. It's just not there. And today, if you looked at the American Rifleman, you're pretty much guaranteed to see the Second Amendment referred to on almost every page. Now, that's not to say that the NRA has completely created this vision of the Second Amendment out of whole cloth. There were court cases in the 1800s that referred to the Second Amendment as protecting a right of people to have guns and to carry guns in public. Just the other day, someone sent me an article written by H.L. Mencken in 1920, where he talks about gun control and makes specific mention of the Second Amendment. So it was out there, and some people did think about it, but that was not the NRA's view of the Second Amendment. And that view of the Second Amendment was really a product of modern-day political organizing. In fact, I recommend readers to check out Michael Waldman-authored piece on Politico that was just published. That's just a great piece about how the Second Amendment was changed as a matter of political debate and political mobilization, and really provides a model for people on both sides of the political spectrum about how to shape interpretation of the Constitution through mobilization of the people. Because ultimately in America, that's really what counts. It doesn't really matter what the framers of the Constitution thought, intended, or wanted to do, despite all of the discussion of originalism. It really matters but what we, the people, as a matter of political mobilization, are willing to fight for and to endorse. You're seeing that now in the same-sex marriage controversy. It's completely irrelevant to whether same-sex marriage will be constitutionally protected. What's completely relevant is what the framers of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War thought about same-sex marriage. It's not coming up in any of the judicial opinions. It's not a prominent part of the public debate. Why is that? Because I don't think on issues of principle like this, at the end of the day, it really doesn't really matter what the framers of the Constitution originally thought. It matters what we, the people, think about it today.
Both of you have also talked about the big change with the Heller case that came up in the Supreme Court. The court really put its stamp on the new meaning of the Second Amendment. Michael Waldman, what happened in the case, and how has this reshaped our discourse?
Well, the Heller case was only heard, and the decision only came down, in 2008. That was the first time that the Supreme Court articulated the holding that the Second Amendment recognizes or confers an individual right to a gun for self-defense. And it was a very significant opinion. It was written by Antonin Scalia. He, of course, is the very vocal proponent of the idea of originalism, or as he might call it, textualism, that the only legitimate way to interpret a constitutional provision is not, as Adam Winkler just said, in the context of the evolution of the country, but by finding a way to go back in time to understand what the framers had in mind or the original public meaning of the words. And Scalia is prone to consulting old dictionaries to find out what the words meant to people at the time. I think he looks sometimes like a Scrabble player trying to prove that that triple score word really exists. It doesn't strike me as the most effective way of really understanding the role of the Constitution, at least what it ought to be. The Heller case was brought not by the NRA, and Adam Winkler really does a fantastic job of telling the story of the case in his book, Gunfight. It was actually brought by a small group of libertarian lawyers who thought the NRA was too timid. Now, the NRA had spent decades helping to foment scholarship, change public opinion, move the elected officials and move the branches. It didn't want to go to the Supreme Court until it was ready. And these activists pushed it. And the case eventually went up. It was a security guard at a federal court office building who wanted to have his gun at home in Washington, D.C. And it was a 5-4 ruling. All the questions just about in the argument were about colonial practices and original intent. There were almost no questions about the things that would previously have been the basis for a Supreme Court ruling. What is the status of gun laws now? What is the problem of gun violence? How do you enforce something like this? It was, in some sense, the triumph of Justice Scalia's vision of originalism. Now, a lot of progressives sort of shrugged and said, well, what do you expect? Some version of that. A lot of conservative judges and writers scalded the opinion. They said, this is just exactly the same kind of loosey-goosey constitutionalism that we've been fighting against. That one conservative judge said, this is as bad as Roe versus Wade, which is, you know, the deepest insult that you can throw, if that's your point of view. What's interesting is that Heller also said, look, like all individual rights, this is an individual right. It applied it only to having a gun that is in common use for protection of your home. That was the explicit holding of the case. And it said, like all individual rights, there are limits. And Scalia indicated some limits, but basically made clear that it was an individual right, but with limits. So, of course, deciding what those limits are and deciding what the reach of the Second Amendment is outside the home, that's consumed courts and legislatures, and that's what the fight is nowadays and going forward.
Adam Winkler.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the Heller case was how it did encourage courts to uphold gun control laws. That for all of the originalism that sort of disguises the opinion, it's dressed up in originalist garb. Towards the end of the opinion, Justice Scalia puts in a paragraph where he says, well, nothing in this opinion should call into question laws banning felons from possessing firearms or laws preventing the mentally ill from possessing firearms or laws regulating guns in sensitive places like schools and government buildings and refers to commercial sale restrictions, something that might be equivalent to background checks or something like that. And the truth is that none of those exceptions that the court recognized were grounded in originalist methodology. They weren't laws that the framers of the Constitution had. They had some gun control laws, as we've talked about already in today's show, but they didn't have the gun control laws that Justice Scalia said were exceptions. And indeed, since the Heller case, we've seen court after court after court uphold challenge gun control laws. There's been several hundred of these cases now. Heller was an invitation for everyone to challenge any gun control law they're ever charged with. And the truth is very few gun laws have been struck down. I don't know what that means for the future. More gun laws may be struck down in the future. I think the biggest open question right now is whether cities like Los Angeles and New York, the cities that Michael and I live in, or whether those cities can have concealed carry policies that give discretion to law enforcement officers over who can get those permits, or whether those cities have to provide permits to any law-abiding person who does mandatory training or meets some minimal requirements. That's really the big open question, and one of the interesting things is that the court seemed really gung-ho on the Second Amendment for a couple of years. 2008, we had the Heller case. 2010, we had a case called McDonald against City of Chicago that applied the Second Amendment and said the Second Amendment applied equally to state and local governments, not just the federal government, as at issue in the Heller case. But the court has subsequently had several cases petitioned to the justices asking them to rule on concealed carry permitting policies. And the justices have just seemingly not shown any interest in it. In fact, just a few weeks ago, they turned down another case, a case that seemed like it was a pretty good case on the facts, if you were a justice who wanted to expand or on Heller and make clear that the right to bear arms does extend into the public sphere and that these concealed carry policies have to meet some kind of constitutional requirements. Not clear at all why the justices keep avoiding the issue now after they seem so gung-ho on it. It may be that the two sides on the court, the four more conservative members of the court and the four more liberal members of the court, that each side is uncertain about what Anthony Kennedy, the usual swing vote on today's court, will do should he get one of these cases. So they just figure, well, let's wait and see what happens. So there's still a lot of uncertainty in the law, but one thing is clear. Heller did not lead to a huge scale back of American gun control laws.
And it's really true that one of the dissents in the case by Justice Breyer, which said basically, well, let's stipulate, sure, it's an individual right, what then? That's, as he says, the beginning, not the end of the analysis. In some ways, that dissent has been a guide for how courts have ruled more than anything else. And in fact, some of the gun rights activists and attorneys who work on it, they've likened the whole thing in the courts to massive resistance, the resistance of southern states to the desegregation decisions in the 1950s. You know, it's actually a rather striking, so far, judicial consensus on most of these things.
Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law and author of The Second Amendment, a biography, and Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, the Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.